You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Alright, this is a bit of an experiment, so bear with me. We're going to be joined here by Grant Newsham. He's a retired Marine colonel. And so let me have to fire up Skype. And we'll see if this works.
Okay, hi, this is Grant here.
Grant, are you there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm here. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, and you can hear me and everything.
I hear you fine. How's my voice?
It's not as masculine as mine, but it's okay.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. Come on. The first of all, we're on the air, so welcome to All Marine Radio. Thank you for doing this.
Okay, my pleasure.
All right. Grant is a retired colonel, retired out of the Marine Corps Reserve, and so we need to learn about you a little bit, Grant, and then we'll go ahead and talk about the Pacific Rim a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
All right. Born and raised where?
I'm from the East Coast, from Virginia.
What part?
Just Northern Virginia, so I'm not really a Southerner.
So you're a Quantico kid? Are you?
No. Just Alexandria, D.C. area.
Okay. How does the Marine Corps get on your horizon?
Probably I was unemployed and $30,000 in debt, but the that said, I always had an interest in it, like a lot of people. And at some point around the age of 27, I thought it would be good to try the Marines, so ended up at Quantico. And next thing was on, never knew how long I would last, but ended up with about 30 years total, active and reserve, during that period.
So, and so why the Marine Corps? You could have done that with, much more sensible alternatives are the Air Force, are the Navy, certainly, and even the Army. The Marine Corps would be a little bit towards the fringe of the bell curve. If you will, why the Marine Corps?
Oh, I think there's a lot of people who somehow or other, my generation in particular, at some point they get sort of focused on or geared towards the Marines. Keep in mind when I was young, probably you too, that guys who were like 40 years old had been in World War II. And they're younger than that, and a lot of them had been in the Marines. And the idea of Iwo Jima and such like was very much something people just knew about. And so you had, I think, someone like me, if you grow up watching Davy Crockett movies, you're probably not going to grow up and be a real estate developer. So at some point in young adult life, there's a sort of a natural convergence with the Marine Corps that meets a need in both directions, I think. And if you can get through the Quantico or Parris Island or Camp Pendleton ends of it, then you can be a good run.
And where'd you go to college?
Oh, I went to a little place called Principia College in Illinois, and then later graduated from UCLA as well, a different degree.
Oh, Bruin. We love the Bruins out here. Unlike those, yeah.
Everybody does. Yes.
Yeah, everybody, except the USC people, and we hate them. So, exactly. So we don't need to go into our little dirty laundry here in Southern California. So Grant, so you joined the Marine Corps. What do you become in the Marine Corps in terms of an MOS?
I was where I started off actually as a lawyer, as a judge advocate. Realized after about a week that this isn't what I joined the Marines to do. So spent the next 29 and a half years doing a lot of other things. But I sort of ended up in the intelligence field for much of that. And ended up ultimately in Japan for about 20 years, because as you mentioned, I was a reservist for a lot of this So I ended up living, went to Japan with the U.S. Foreign Service, was in Tokyo, and then left and moved over to the private sector and worked for an investment bank for a good long while. So for that period, I was effectively MARFOR PAC, Marine Forces Pacific's guy in Asia. So that was where my closest connections were reserve-wise, and a little bit down the 3MEF in Okinawa, but a lot with MARFOR PAC. And over that period, I worked with MARFOR PAC's G2 a lot, and was also the reserve G2 for a while, and also a lot with the G5, sort of doing kind of like foreign area officer work involving Japan, but also the rest of Asia as well.
So that lays out a career path. Give me a couple people that have made huge contributions to you as a leader. And you can't give me the kind of the colonel thing like, oh, Mac, if I only named two, it'd be so unfair to everybody else. Give me a couple people that made a huge, had a lasting imprint on you relative to leadership.
Well, that is a good question, because there certainly are people. I could tell you people who made them, very rare, who made an impression of how not to act. But those are actually surprisingly rare.
Hey, no, you know, we'll take those two. That's probably a much more interesting discussion.
Oh, of course it is, but everybody has it. But I would say that, goodness, the SPC, the student platoon commander at TBS, made a huge difference. A fellow named Steve Girton, or Captain Steve Girton. He really got people off on the right track in seeing that you could, you know, be a good Marine officer, but also have fun. And he had the right sort of sense about things. They were just a pleasure to be around. And it was better than having the sort of the shaved haired, screaming head lunatics that one can sometimes come across.
Hey, let's leave the infantry community alone.
No, but he was an infantry officer. So but we come in all types. And also I would suggest another example. I never knew him, but my parents were acquainted with a Marine general named O.P. Smith, who saved the 1st Marine Division at Chosin Reservoir and one might say saved the Marine Corps.
Right.
And I never met him, but they would mention him now and then, particularly when I got involved with the Marines, as he was said to be just a huge gentleman, you know, a real Marine that knew his stuff. But at the same time, a dignified gentleman. So the Marines come in all types, but those are a couple guys. I would cite a fellow named General Chip Gregson, who over the years has been a very good example of how the Marine officers can carry themselves. So when you stop and think about it, there's always a long list of people, and they pop up. And I could probably, if I took the time, come up with, oh, goodness, 30 or 40 Marine officers, either junior below me or contemporaries or above me in rank, who through the years made a huge difference.
Chip Gregson was my 1st Battalion commander at 1st Battalion 5th Marines in 1984. He's always a smart guy, and he a gentleman, too, a good guy. Interesting. Talk to me about contingencies you've deployed to, Grant. So how many different times have you been involved in contingencies?
Contingencies. A recent one was when I was in Japan, was after the tsunami earthquake up in Tohoku, or northern Japan. And I was at my civilian job at the bank and thought I was going to die. It was a big earthquake in Tokyo. But once that was over, the next day I got a call from Hawaii asking me if I would come on active duty and be useful, and was able eventually to get up to Tohoku, where the center of the relief effort was, and played a role with the coordinating cell, linking what the Americans were doing with the Japanese in that effort. And there was a couple things that really stood out from that that have some immediate relevance. The first of them is that in the first 24, 48 hours, the Japanese military, which got up to Sendai very quickly, and the Navy in particular, the Japanese Navy got up there, they basically let 3,000 or 4,000 people die, freeze to death, because they had no amphibious capability, they had no joint capability for doing HADR, humanitarian assistance, disaster relief efforts. And that was, one knew it was going to happen because the word amphibious was taboo in Japan for many years, even though there were Japanese Army and Navy officers who knew it was necessary. So this was something that pointed out a huge shortcoming in Japanese military capabilities, this lack of amphibious, lack of joint capability. And that was a sort of quite a striking thing to see. And it's manifests itself today. Efforts are being made to fix it, but 60 years of neglect is not fixed in an afternoon. The second sort of main or sort of really striking thing up there was when the Marines from Okinawa got up, they sent a detachment up really fast, got there within a couple days, flying the old CH-46s.
Right.
And they, when they got there, do you know what the Japanese Army's response was? Well, you probably won't.
I won't. I have none.
It was, who are you and what are you doing here? So keep in mind that the Marines and the U.S. military have been in Asia, have been in Japan since like the day after, since late 1945. And the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Force was that unfamiliar with the Marines and with U.S. forces in general, and effectively unable to easily, to smoothly conduct a real-world operation. And that was, those were two, I think, really big lessons that came up in the course of Operation Tomodachi, the relief effort, that from a Marine perspective, I think were valuable.
I'm somewhat puzzled by that, Grant, because we do, so this is just a novices. What's the exercise, Steel Knight? What's the one we do with the Japanese here in the spring?
There's Iron Fist.
Iron Fist.
Right now, actually.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But that is just, is that us with the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Force? They send naval shipping over, so there's some Navy involvement, but and I thought that we'd be involved in different bilateral military events so that they wouldn't be scratching their heads. Should I be surprised when the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Force guys look up and say, who are you and what are you doing here?
You should be surprised in the sense that people, if you don't live and breathe things Japanese, and if you're happy with things going along smoothly as they are, but without much thought to Japanese capabilities and their ability to work with us, then you wouldn't. You would be surprised. But it's something from a perspective that historically was just determined that, we would declare we had a wonderful relationship with the Japanese because we lived there and, they didn't kick us out. But nobody actually gave much thought to how much of an actual capability they had and how it would fit in with us. Now, what you've described, however, is Exercise Iron Fist, which has been going on since about 2006. And the Japanese send basically a really big platoon, maybe a company, a small company, over to Camp Pendleton to get some experience going through amphibious activities. They get on Navy ships, they do helicopter landings on San Clemente Island, jump out of do helicasting, and interact with Marines. So they actually do get sort of familiarity is how I would put it. And this whole exercise was once again, General Gregson had a huge role in starting it. There were a couple Japanese reformers and the guys who knew what needed done in the Japanese Army who also greased the skids from that end. And then there was a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel named James Whitlatch who worked as a consultant who really right. deserves a lot of credit for keeping this spark alive. But this was just a small thing that wasn't that was just a very, very tentative step towards really developing useful capabilities, useful relationships with the Japanese from the Marine Corps perspective, and also to give them something of an taste of amphibious capability. But the other exercise you described is where the Japanese actually sent three Japanese Navy ships to Southern California, and they operate with U.S. Navy ships, with Marines, and in something much more like a joint task force. That's called Dawn Blitz exercise.
Right.
And the first time the Japanese came was in 2013, and it was considered revolutionary to get them to send three ships across the ocean and do basically amphibious operations. It was a landmark event. This was considered impossible by experts on both sides. And then they came back in 2015 and did it again and did it even better. And the Marines and the Navy really did a good job of drawing the Japanese in, treating them like full equals. And this was immensely important. But you'll notice it started in 2013. So this is some decades where we were kind of happy doing these small little events. Generally where we would meet, shake hands, operate in parallel, and then at the end have a barbecue where the top dogs claimed everything was perfectly okay. But it really wasn't. So we're late in the day getting this fixed.
But a far cry from actually being integrated, understanding each other, and working together, because I think the term parallel is a term pregnant certainly with meeting in terms of for a lack of integration. Yes, we're together. We are going to have a barbecue, and there's going to be articles that appear in the American media, but we're not intertwined, which certainly we do need to be.
It sounds cynical or just glib, but that actually is the case more often than not,
right.
And not just with Japan and in large parts of Asia, with these relationships we have. It's not to say a lot of good work hasn't been done, but we really haven't got those linkages. Just an observation over the years, and I'm not the first one to have noticed it. But it really became an issue probably about 7 or 8 years ago, once really Chinese assertiveness in East Asia, Northeast Asia in particular, really became undeniable. And that has changed the dynamic. At some point, it does matter if you are able to operate with the country's military smoothly and effectively. So that's the things changed back about then in terms of sort of perceptions. There were more people who saw that a long time, what was needed a long time ago, but they were howling in the wilderness too more often than not.
The world has changed incredibly. All right. So now that we know who you are, Grant, and where you come from and what your perspective is on the world and how you got there, tell me, where are you today? Where are you physically located on the planet?
Right now I'm in Hawaii. I'm here a good bit of the time, though I get back and forth to Japan often and here and there in Southeast Asia as well.
All right. So much news, the Marine Corps announced, 24, 36 months, our pivot to the Pacific. Coincidentally, there's been people yelling about this for years, that we need to pay attention. The Pacific is going to become an increasingly important theater for the United States as China's economic power grows and they begin to assert themselves and flex their muscles. So it seems like that day has arrived. We see more and more, how would I characterize it? More and more incidences, and we could talk about the Spratly Islands. I mean, just this weekend we could talk about China and their pulling back from purchasing coal from North Korea, which seems to be a fairly interesting item. But let me ask you a general kind of overarching question before we kind of begin talking specific things. What is the general lay of the land? And I'll set it up by saying this. I had General Tulin on maybe a month ago, who I know. He said, you know, Mac, the Chinese, maybe quite rightly, have deduced that our relationship with Australia, the Philippines, Vietnam, Taiwan, Japan, Korea, Guam, and he's naming them off, he said is designed to hem them in. And they are looking for a way to break that containment. He said, so you're going to see them do things. So as a general situation comment, Grant, how do you see the general dance that's going on in the Pacific Rim right now?
Where I would look at it, and it's a question of perspective, I don't know where you sit, or just the efforts of the U.S. to strengthen its long-standing relationships with a number of Asian countries are just as easily viewed as our effort to assert to protect our interests, you know, in a system based on consensual government, rule of law, long-standing allies. And we are just as much asserting our interests as trying to hem anybody in. If we were going to hem the Chinese in, we'd know how to do it. We'd do it even better. This is really just standing up for ourselves. But that's just a question of perspective.
All right.
And the Chinese would see it differently. But ultimately, the Chinese have been very clear for a long time that their intent is to displace the United States in East Asia as the leading power, and ultimately to displace, to sort of elbow us out of the region. You hear of the so-called first island chain and the second island chains, and the first island chain being on a line about from Japan down through the Taiwan and the Philippines and, say, to along to Indonesia. Mm-hmm. The second one, if you made a line going farther out with Guam, sort of the eastern extremity, the Chinese have been very clear that, you know, they're going to dominate the first island chain, and then that's just the beginning. And then the second chain is really to dominate and control out to there, to really keep a serious opponent out. And we say this has been clear for at least the last 15, 20 years to anyone who followed it, but we've chosen not to believe what they've said. But it's gotten to the point where the Chinese have de facto control of the South China Sea. Or at a minimum, or within a hair's breadth of it. And that is just the start. There's this unrelenting pressure from the Chinese that tends to wear people down. But there's definitely sort of a push by the Chinese to ultimately displace the United States in the region. And this isn't just a military push. There's economic angles. There's political warfare, which is going on, and psychological warfare as well. So we've never been in a position this difficult that I can think of. And yeah, I think in baseball terms, one might almost say it's up to the bottom of the seventh and we're down by about five. One should also keep in mind that China is not just a larger version of Canada, but rather it's the People's Republic of China. It's ultimately authoritarian, it's thuggish, and it is about as opposed to these things that we and a lot of other people consider important, as I've mentioned, consensual government, individual liberty, rule of law, let's say a legal system that actually works, honest, basically honest trade, and a system of open seas, in particular, open skies as well. So it very much reflects a different sort of a different set of values than we would have. But then they do, of course, you know, believe what they say, and so they do have an opinion and a perspective of things that that they believe firmly. But just as we have a perspective that we believe in, firmly as well.
Well, does that mean that our perspective? It sounds like our perspectives are on a collision course, because what we're talking about is the exact opposite of what exists today.
No, that's something we'll find out. The U.S. approach to China since the Kissinger era, say in the early 70s, has, and really right up to just a few months ago, and I hope perhaps it's changed, has ultimately been that if China is accommodated, understood, and even helped develop militarily, that it will eventually liberalize, that it will become effectively more like us. That China would see the benefits of the international system that allows sort of equality between all states, open trade, and sort of a rule of set international laws that have worked very well for some decades now. The idea was that China would eventually, say, liberalize, and it's effectively a science experiment, and it hasn't happened. Now, one would think that after half a century, one might recognize that accommodation, which often looks suspiciously like the old 1930s appeasement, really has not paid off. And now what one's seeing is simply an effort on the part of the U.S. to simply not appease, and that tends to look kind of forceful when you stop doing that, but really it's not doing much more than we would normally be doing just in terms of military operations and a military presence. But it does require a willingness not to back down all the time.
Hold on. Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
All the time? What did that little aside mean?
Well, there was a historically, but certainly in the last while, the immediate response to any Chinese assertiveness in East Asia, particularly involving the United States or even its allies, was to de-escalate. And that was the expression that you would hear is de-escalate. Yeah. What can we do to make the problem go away?
What does that mean?
Well, it means if you give in to whatever it is the Chinese are doing and don't complain and don't push back, other than perhaps a sternly worded expression of concern from some part of the D.C. establishment, well, that will de-escalate the situation, but certainly not to bump back or to apply any real pressure. That would include economic pressure. That it has been this fundamental disposition to, once again, de-escalate that has gotten us into rather a disadvantage.
My guest here is a retired Marine Corps. Retired, yes, Grant?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, retired in what year? We never got to that.
Oh, yeah, I finished up a couple years ago.
Okay, retired Marine Corps Colonel Grant Newsham. And we're talking about his expertise in the Pacific Rim region. And I've got an email for you, Grant, and then we've got to take a quick break, and then we'll continue if you don't mind. Mac, very interesting your discussion this morning with Colonel Newsham. Question for him. I've heard you say that friends of yours that have been with Office of Legislative Affairs have gone through China and have been very, very interested in the reaction of their military escorts and their conversations relating the fact that the Chinese are more concerned with a civil war within their country than they are with an external conflict. I'm curious to what Colonel Newsham has to say about that. So, Grant, that in fact is I have friends that have gone through there, and China is not a settled nation. And I'm curious your thoughts about their observation.
It's a, you know, there's something to that, but it is possible to have two things going on at once.
Right.
Certainly, that you're right, China, there is a degree of instability, and certainly an even more latent instability in China. It's worth noting that for many years, the internal security budget has been higher than the defense budget. And that's not by coincidence. It's a society that run by the Chinese Communist Party that's only claim to running the place is economic growth. And if you upset that, then you've got some real problems. The potential for sort of internal unrest is considerable. And it always is in those kinds of societies or kind of governments. Additionally, corruption is a huge problem. It's what brought down the old KMT before Mao Zedong took over. And the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party leaders, know this. And that's partly behind the effort by the current president to try to do something about it. That may be shoveling against the tide. But you're right, there is internal instability. But at the same time, that the China is just as capable of, once again, asserting itself outwards. And as I said, it has got de facto control of the South China Sea. That's an area bigger than the Mediterranean Ocean. You've seen the island building campaign they've gone about in the last couple years.
Right.
That has, in very short order, created a very quite serviceable military bases in the South China Sea, extending their reach. And just look at what the Chinese regularly do militarily outwards in the Indian Ocean beyond. Throughout and down into the South Pacific, that despite any internal weaknesses and difficulties, it is still extremely capable of asserting itself outwards. So the two things are not mutually exclusive. In fact, the classic response to internal sort of unrest is actually to divert attention by pushing outwards. So once again, one hears that argument, oh, we're so busy just trying to keep order in our own country, we couldn't possibly be a threat to anybody. But the evidence of one's own eyes suggests that's different.
All right, we're going to take a break, Grant. And when we come back, I want you to explain for us, and again, I'll quote General Tulin, those islands are designed to break, contain, and to intimidate, those two things. And if you want to stand up to us, then you can run the risk of us shutting off Chinese markets to you. So you're going to decide in short order which side of the fence you're going to fall on. So when we come back, I want you to answer to that, and we're going to take a quick break. My guests, we're talking about the Pacific Rim, an incredibly interesting conversation with retired Marine Corps Colonel Grant Newsham. He from Northern Virginia, the Alexandria area to be specific, and more of Al-Marine Radio. More of Al-Marine Radio coming up next right here on a Monday, President's Day here in the United States, on the All-Warrior Radio Network.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you. And we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
Edward Sergeant Gnarly Ermey here with important information for veterans. At 2,600 American job centers nationwide, veteran and transitioning military personnel can find help with career counseling, resumes, and job placement. You want more information, don't you? The Department of Labor offers a variety of programs to help our military heroes find good jobs or continue their education. What are you waiting for?
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour of All Marine Radio brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the Battle Mug itself. Starts as a 10.5-pound block of billet aluminum. After milling, machining, and anodization, it's ready for you to customize. It's got Picatinny rails on it, so a scope, a laser, whatever you put on your rifle, you can certainly put on your mug, throw a top on there so you don't dump your hot coffee in your lap when you check something out, and you've got a part of your kit. Very cool. If you've never seen them, check them out on battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. It's a veteran-owned, Marine-owned company. And made entirely in the United States. Check them out. Battlemug.com, a great sponsor of All Marine Radio. Graciously holding with us through the break is Grant Newsham, a retired Marine colonel and currently making his living out in the Pacific. Grant, is that your home now? Is Hawaii your home?
Oh, I suppose, as much as anywhere. It used to be Japan for 20 years. So... it's hard to say, but I'm here more often than not. I find every time I go back to Japan, I feel a little bit more like a tourist.
I've got an email for you, and then I want to talk about the Spratly Islands, the island building campaign, if you will. The email says this: Hey Mac, has Japan digested its post-war II guilt yet, and are they going to join the rest of us in the League of Nations that, as full-fledged members with a full military, because we certainly need that. I think it's time, with 80 years in the rearview mirror, and that we get over World War II and that Japan becomes what it should be. Are they interested in being that? Will their public allow them to be that? So, Grant, it's been interesting with the, you know, President of the United States going to Japan for the anniversaries in August of our use of nuclear weapons, and then the Prime Minister of Japan going to Pearl Harbor to make comments there as well. Give us your take on that. Is Japan having its coming out party?
Oh, it's having. It's done more in the last 4 or 5 years than it has done in the previous 30 or 40. Prime Minister Abe is really the first statesman Japan has had as a prime minister for a long time. He's got a sense of what Japan needs to do, and it is to, as the emailer suggested, it's to have Japan do more militarily. Just for too long, it was just writing checks and standing by, claiming that it couldn't do anything. And, you know, in some ways, this is an understandable outcome of having gotten obliterated in World War II, which we often tend to overlook. But that, as noted, that's 75 years ago now. And Japan is changed. It's, and once again, not least, the prime minister is doing his best to have Japan do some more commonsensical things militarily. And effectively, he's bringing it back to the center, from a sort of an extreme, unrealistic, sort of faux pacifism. And I say faux pacifism, a fake pacifism, because the Japanese have always been glad to have the Americans standing by to exterminate anyone who might threaten Japan. And that's a strange version of pacifism. But the...
yeah, I think it's called having a big brother. I mean, there's a lot of kids that have walked around neighborhoods that are pretty rough, that had pretty tough big brothers, that were very peaceful kids.
So Japan has militarily has developed a self-defense force, which has some capabilities and on paper is powerful. But ultimately, it's been pathologically dependent on the United States. So one gets used to that sort of thing. So it takes some time to recover from that. But specifically, what is needed is for Japan to spend a lot more money on its own defense, not on us, but on its own defense, and to figure out how to have their Army, Navy, and Air Force operate together. They're basically incapable of simple joint operations. That has to be corrected quickly. But the writer's absolutely right that this linkage with Japan and the United States is the key to stability in Asia. And globally, it has a very good effect. But in Asia, if you could... it's the political linkage, that psychological linkage between us and Japan that is really manifested in a Japan self-defense force and U.S. military that can really work together and operate together like we used to with the British, before the British decided they didn't want a military. But that really is the key to everything. And Chinese planners know this. But it is when you can get the Americans linked up with the Japanese as deeply as possible, it has a stabilizing effect. And other countries in Asia notice this as well, and that's something they would like to see. And Mr. Abe has done some good work in this area, and the U.S. is doing more. Defense guidelines between the U.S. and Japan were rewritten about a year and a half ago. For which the guys at PACOM and in D.C. and on the Japanese side deserve a lot of credit. But as long as Mr. Abe's here, there's a chance to move it forward. There's a long way to go, given the past, but at least we've got a chance now.
All right, another email. Mac, after he answers that question, sneak this one in before he talks about the Spratlys. Is it possible that Japan will turn its back on quote-unquote militarization in an effort to maintain its peaceful way that it's maintained? I know this. I was watching General Mattis this weekend in Europe delivering a message. Hey, we need you to rebuild your militaries. We need you to contribute the 2% that you said you would contribute in the NATO agreement. I think that's reasonable, and I think his comment that there should be no way the people of the United States and the American military should be more interested in your freedom than you are is right on the money. Does the same thing apply to Japan, and is there more serious discussion about it, given the fact that China is rippling its muscles as it extends itself into the Pacific?
It's a good question, and there's... a couple sort of ideas on that. I don't think it's as likely with Japan. However, if Japan thinks that it cannot count on the United States for America's full support and that includes to defend these little islands called the Senkakus down in the south. If America doesn't, if Japan doesn't think it can count on the Americans, that will really cause some problems in the relationship. One could almost imagine it destroying the relationship. But on the question of whether or not there's this sort of, I don't know, this pacifistic force or undercurrent in Japan, which might just cause the country to say, okay, we give up, we'll become the next Finland, and that it's there, but I think you can actually make an interesting distinction between the political world, the politicians in Japan, and the public at large. The politicians actually are a far more, how do you call it, appeasing type, surprisingly often. And there is a sort of a constituency which would say that Japan need not stand up for itself. It's not worth the trouble. It might as well just accede to what China is trying to do. But the public at large, when they have Japan's defense requirements explained to them, that they are very supportive of a sort of a more centrist, a more realistic Japanese sort of defense policy. So it's an odd distinction to find, but I don't really see that happening. It's conceivable, but at the same time, I think it's as long as if things continue as they are, and that I think it's less likely to happen than one might think.
Interesting. All right, now let's transition to the Spratly Islands. What give us your take? What is going on there?
Well, General Tulin characterized it properly in terms of what those islands mean. China has basically set out on a campaign since about 2012 to build artificial islands in these islands that extend south from way south from mainland China, and are in other people's maritime territory. And they put things like 10,000 foot runways, effectively deep water ports there. And it allows you to conduct military operations from much farther out, extend your control and your assertiveness in both operational terms, practically, but also the psychological domination that comes of having, once again, just laid claim to and effectively put yourself in a position to control an area bigger than the Mediterranean Ocean, Mediterranean Sea, that has historically been open seas. And it's regarded that way under international law. And China has just said, well, we don't care. It's because a Chinese fisherman laid eyes on it sometime in the last 2,000 years. It's part of China. And unfortunately, you can actually figure out when this really became a serious problem. It was in 2012 when China made a move for an atoll called the Scarborough Shoals that is only about 100 miles from the Philippines, well within Philippine territory. And the Chinese laid their claim. The Philippines came, sent out a tiny little Coast Guard ship to whatever it was to get trying to assert their interests. The U.S. State Department brokered an agreement where both sides would pull out. Filipinos pulled out. The Chinese just stayed there. Unfortunately, the U.S. did nothing. And that was the green light that started this island-building campaign in earnest. And now these islands are there, and they are not going to be rolled back. There is no way the Chinese are going to pull out of these things. So we've spotted it's in baseball terms, spotted somebody more runs than they ought to have.
Hey, Grant, what was the name of that island?
It's called Scarborough Shoals.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And for anyone who's listening or interested, when you look at a map, it everything makes sense. And it's, more than reading anything, look at a map and you can really see what has happened and what's changed, but also why it's being done from China's perspective.
I just looked it up on Google Earth. Wow. What's next? Manila Bay?
Well, maybe not that far. I don't think they have to, but the Philippine leadership being what it is.
So what is the intent of all this? Is it, as General Tulin said, to break containment? Is it designed to provoke a confrontation with the United States? What is the end state of all of this?
It's to have the U.S. give up and concede concede the major political, military, economic power in Asia in favor of China. And ultimately to have the U.S. operate basically from Hawaii, about that far back. And to have the rest of the nations in Asia just once again concede and that China is the leading power, whose interests must always be considered and ultimately obeyed. And that's where it's headed. In terms of breaking out, regardless of how anything the Americans are perceived as doing or anyone else is perceived as doing, if you look at the geography, and I've mentioned this first island chain, and it's very useful to look at the region. If you take a map and turn it so you're looking outwards from China, and what you see is an island barrier extending from the north of Japan all the way down to Indonesia. And the Ryukyus, where Okinawa is, are right in the middle of that chain, and it is genuinely a geographic chain. It's a geographic barrier that would exist no matter what. And that is from China's perspective, if you want easy access to the ocean, you've got to do something about those islands. And that will go a long way to helping a person understand the Chinese perspective on this. And just as you can break a chain, it's also you can easily use a chain, if necessary, to hold people in.
You know, as you're looking at Google Earth, it is those, that is the natural barrier that China would use to protect itself. The problem, however, is that natural barrier is the Korean Peninsula, is Japan, is Okinawa, is Taiwan, is the Philippines. And every one of them, with the exception of the Philippines here recently, is in the American sphere. Two questions for you. And Grant, let me just tell you, thank you. I mean, it's wonderful to have you on today to talk about these things in depth, and certainly at least in depth to us novices to this discussion. Mike, an email question. Hey Mac, I'm looking at the Spratly Islands, which I've read about. All right, Scarborough Shoal, are you kidding me? The Spratlys aren't even a concern given where Scarborough Shoal is. So is there a red line? Dare they go any closer? By my calculation, relative to Scarborough Shoal to the Philippines, it's 150 miles off their coast. Am I wrong about that?
No, it's pretty close. It's just a brazen grab, and ultimately, and the lesson to be learned here, this is obvious to anyone who's done business with China or otherwise, is that if you don't operate from a position of strength, you have no chance. And if you're dealing with the Canadians, that a concession will be welcome as a sign of good neighborliness and perhaps responded to with another concession on their part. But that isn't how it works here. And it's such a fundamental mistake. It's unfortunate that the U.S. government made it. But it's in a paradoxically that to the extent that one is willing to defend oneself, or really take a strong position, you actually reduce the risk of conflict. It's this constant acquiescence that actually emboldens the other side. And I would note that there's nobody threatens China. There is absolutely nobody who wants to cause China harm, to attack it. and any suggestion to the otherwise is just nonsense. But this is a, unfortunately, it's, you've got two sort of competing perspectives at stake here. We'll see how this plays out. But the, once again, you look at a map, and it's the brazenness of the South China Sea land seizures and sea seizures that are really are striking, have some resemblance to the 1930s in some respects.
In fact, I was just going to mention that. What did we forget about, you know, the Anschluss and then giving Hitler Poland, looking the other way, Czechoslovakia, and all the rest of that? What did we forget? And let me take you back. A final question for you, Grant. And again, I hope you don't mind if I bug you on a regular basis, Grant. I've loved the conversation, to be honest with you.
I'm brimming with.
It is all marine radio, so you have to give us something. The Kissinger's approach to China. Were you king or queen for a day relative to American foreign policy? It sounds like appeasement maybe could be concealed by an intellectual by saying, well, you know, at some point, given the level of technology and the sophistication that China's moving towards, they will have their own revolution and all this will go away. What do you say to that?
I would give Mr. Kissinger and Nixon a break on this. You know, because they had their ideas, and the idea was really to deal with the Soviet Union by getting closer with China. So it's but at some point, you know, your hypothesis, if you're doing a science experiment, the evidence isn't backing it up. At some point. And I would suggest after 45 years, that's usually long enough to maybe reconsider the hypothesis. But I think where you'd really draw a difference is really a change, a distinction, is say after the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, is that from that point is when China just manifestly saw the United States as an enemy. But before that, there was an argument to be made. But since then, it's been an extremely adversarial relationship, even though we have not chosen to admit it. To say I would give the early guys a break, but it's been clear since about 1989 what China's intentions are in Asia. And we just say, once again, chose not to believe them. For whatever reasons, and I think that was a mistake. Part of it is the allure of the Chinese market with belief that American business can sell one of something to every person in China. That remains an illusion or mirage that it hasn't really paid off for most people. But there's been a number of reasons why we've convinced ourselves not to respond firmly to China's outward assertiveness. But there's also a sense that anything is better than the possibility of conflict. And yes, that's, you know, there's something to be said for that, but there is a point, I think the human experience teaches us that at some point you've got to stand up. Why don't people remember the 30s? Well, I think every generation thinks they're superior, they're better, and that this is different. Somehow it's different. But one might suggest human nature doesn't change so much. And just one last thing, it's interesting if you read some of the commentary from the 30s and read some of the commentary from today, you could sometimes transpose the word Czechoslovakia for Taiwan or vice versa, and you wouldn't know which was written when. There's always been an idea that you have to, if you just understand the aggressive parties' perspective and give them what they want, address their fears, that you can make trouble go away. I'm not so sure the evidence backs that up.
You know, we could talk about this for another couple hours, but our time is concluded, Grant. I've got one more email for you that I want to get to before I let you go. Mac, I'm curious about the odds that this behavior is kind of a long-term behavior that China will consistently engage in. Again, I believe you're right in terms of using its markets. If you want to stand up to us militarily, we'll deal with that. But at the same time, we'll close our markets to you, and you will pay the price for that. So you can either let us do what we will do, and in that case, I believe that the island building will continue, and it will be applied to the contested islands that the Japanese own. Does Grant believe that will be that will come to fruition, and will the United States stop it there, or at least be in for a confrontation? So, Grant, get out your crystal ball. We're going to
We're going to
get into a confrontation with China soon.
We've been in a confrontation with them for a long time. It's just a question of how you respond. I would like to think there will not be a shooting war or a shooting incident. In fact, I just really hope there isn't. It's not necessary. And it would be worse than anybody imagines, in my opinion. So I'm hoping it doesn't come to that. But once
Hold on. When you say worse than anybody imagined, what do you mean by that?
There's some, to the extent people think about it, I think there's a belief that, we can just fire a few shots and then talk about it and work things out and it'll go back to normal.
Right.
But these things always go on longer and cause a lot more trouble than one imagines. If you want to see a stock market go down 19,000 points in an hour, it'll just take one shot. But this is bad. But once again, if you don't stand up for yourself, in a case like this, the chances of conflict being pushed, the chances of conflict become higher as one gets pushed into a position from its either surrender or fight back. So the stronger we are, the more we can begin to prevent this possibility. In terms of the East China Sea, where Japan's islands are, those are coming. It's just one thing at a time, and right. China now and then pushes on the Southeast China Sea, pulls back, does more in the South China Sea, once in a while gets up to the Yellow Sea. Oh, but this is definitely on the menu, and that's coming, and even I could figure that out. But the Chinese have been very clear. They consider the East China Sea theirs as well, and they've even said that the Ryukyus are Chinese as well. But one thing at a time.
Holy smokes.
That's where it's going.
All right. Well, it'll be certainly has people's attention. And, Grant, first, it was a pleasure to have met you. And this is the first time I've ever used Skype to conduct an interview. So I'm happy to learn that we can do that, which makes you accessible to me on a regular basis. So thank you very much. All the best of you, and thank you for making us a little bit smarter. And the next time you can continue our education relative to not only our relationship with Japan, but also the dynamic between Japan, China, the United States. And hold on, one more email, Mac. I'm curious Grant's thoughts about what's going on in the Philippines now. Will that guy last? Is he the Filipino version of Donald Trump? What is going to happen to the Philippines? It seems like they're on the verge, like Turkey, of leaving our orbit as well. Is their relationship too close to the United States for that to happen? And will we survive this, or is the relationship in jeopardy?
Well, I think if we give it some time in the Philippines, it'll work itself out. Mr. Duterte he was elected president. He actually has a lot of popularity, and he has his outlook on things. But once again, give it some time. We've seen a number of different leaders in the Philippines, and there's a lot of also competing forces in the Philippines. So, there's pro-American, pro-Chinese. There's all sorts of forces. As I give it some time to play out, we have a good long relationship with them. It's important to look at what is actually done rather than provocative statements that might be made. We've had something similar with Malaysia when Mahathir was in power in the 90s, that he said things, but at the same time, the basic relationship, it continued. This is, of course, a disruption, but once again, some patience and continued attention to the Philippines. And I think we, after a year or two, we may actually find things have improved, especially if we take a sort of less appeasing sort of stance towards our activities in Asia. If we do more to promote American interests in Asia, that I think you may find a bandwagoning effect on some of the other countries there, including the Philippines. So I just give it some time.
All right. They keep coming in, so don't hate me. Mac, I'm curious, Grant's thoughts on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that President Trump scrapped. Does that help us or hurt us in the eyes of the Japanese? So the Japanese perspective of that agreement.
I think Mr. Abe is, you know, he's disappointed because he went to great lengths to take on his farmers union, his farmers, in order to pass TPP. And that is, it was huge. That was pretty brave of him to do it. And he was successful. It'd be like taking on the teachers union in the United States or something, but even stronger than that.
God forbid.
Feeling a little like he, like I did my part. What about you?
Right.
So they're miffed, but it's not the, I'd say it's not the end of the day. It would have been nice perhaps to have the sort of the political benefits that come from the U.S. having the lead on this trade agreement. But in terms of actual sort of economic value, I'm not sure there was a whole lot. But the, it's, you know, it's unfortunate, that it didn't pass, but maybe there's a way to work around it. One does note that whilst Mr. Trump actually killed it, Mr. Obama didn't exactly spend much ammunition trying to pass it. And Mrs. Clinton was going to kill it as well, she said. But that said, I don't see it as a huge problem. I would settle for having the U.S. Army, U.S. Marines and the Japanese Army having radios that could talk to each other. More than TPP, I'm half joking. But one thing, before I leave, I just have to mention it, because the U.S. Navy-Japanese Navy relationship is the exception to everything I said in terms of what is wrong between the U.S. forces and the Japanese. They have developed an excellent operational relationship going back probably 40, 50 years. And they do, if you just look at what they do and then have everyone else do it, that's a very good guide. But I had to mention that because I'm actually envious of what the Navies have accomplished.
No, we love the Navy. And to be honest with you, the spotlight is falling on the Navy more and more in terms of, you know, our relationships around the world, the Navy's relationship with Iran in around the Straits of Hormuz. And I think the Navy better, you know, they better button their chin straps, because at some point they're going to get into a shooting conflict with somebody. And it may not be a long one, but it certainly could be a deadly one. And the same thing as they do the dance in the South China Sea with the Chinese. So hopefully that will, everybody keeps their cool. But the spotlight falling once again on the United States Navy. So hopefully they're up for it. But thank you for making that point. Grant, it was a pleasure to have you on. Thank you very much.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks
all right,
very much.
You bet. We'll do it again. That is Grant Newsham, Colonel, United States Marine Corps Reserve, retired, and currently out in Hawaii. So we'll do that again. I mean, what an interesting guy. I love that. We're going to take a break. The Gunner joins us next here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.